So I am excited to welcome our first presenter. Michael Halpert is a professor of economics at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. He's been a member of Sabre since 1985, and he is co-chair of Sabre's Business of Baseball Committee, where he is also the editor of the newsletter Outside the Lines. He's published more than 60 articles on the business of baseball, and his work on the history of baseball salaries has been cited by numerous authors, including many of our Black Sox scandal research committee members. He's a frequent presenter at Sabre conferences, and he was the 2014 recipient of Sabre's Doug Pappas Award for the best oral presentation at the Sabre convention. Please welcome Michael Halpert to speak on How Cheap Was Charles Comiskey's Salaries and the Black Sox? Thank you.
Thank you very much. And as Jacob said, my background is in economics. So these panelists up here probably forgot more about the Black Sox scandal since their session ended than I ever knew. But I do know something about salaries, and I've done a lot of work on that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And so really quickly, let me jump to the answer. How cheap was Charlie Comiskey? Very cheap, but no cheaper than anybody else at that time. So we're going to put this into perspective a little bit, because what I'm about to show you probably isn't going to be news to anybody here, that the players were not underpaid, that the myths about their salaries and their bonuses. But let me just go through that and talk a little bit about this. So first, the very boring stuff here, that as an academic, what you always do is tell everyone what's wrong with your research before they get a chance to tell you. This is a work in progress. The numbers may change. There are some missing contracts. So I'm going to look at the contracts and try and reconstruct the payrolls for the 1919 teams. This research is done largely from the contract cards, which are misappropriately labeled the transaction card files at the Hall of Fame, which are these cards that each team would write up a contract, and they all use standard contracts, and then they would send a copy of the contract to the league office. The league office would then take the contract, and on index cards, they would transcribe all of the amounts that you would fill in the blanks, so the date, the name, the amount, and then they would note any bonuses that had been added to the contract, because the standard player contract has no bonuses, and then they would note anything that was crossed off of that contract, so if something was deleted. So all of that was transcribed on index cards originally, and then computer printouts later on, and there are tens of thousands of these cards in shoeboxes, well, not exactly shoeboxes, but they're about shoebox size, roughly arranged in alphabetical order. And I say roughly because most of the A's are in A, but then they're only semi-alphabetically after that. So I spent 10 years photographing all of these cards, and only now am I going back and trying to, you know, extract all the data and put it into a format that I can use. So some of the contracts I have not been able to find, but that doesn't mean they weren't there. It just means they, you know, if I'm looking for Allen and it's not under the A's, it could have actually been under the B's. So what I do have, though, is a lot of the data, and I would probably say I'm about 95% sure that I've got these payrolls pretty close to being right. So let's go ahead and take a look. So as I mentioned, the stuff is at the Hall of Fame. This is what these contract cards look like, okay? So there's a card for each player, sometimes multiple cards, depending on how long their season was. You can see that what they do is they just type this stuff in, and they just keep adding to it year after year, so the lines don't line up, the color of the ink on the ribbon of the typewriter changes, the color of the cards changes, and there's no particular rhyme or reason for the color of the cards. But that's an example of what you're looking at in these 50-some thousand odd cards that I've photographed. And another source of information for salaries, and a better source really, is the actual team financial documents, which are really rare. There are very few of those. In fact, the first work that I did on salaries was finding a cache of this material for the New York Yankees for the Jacob Rupert years. So it turns out that what happened when a guy named George Steinbrenner bought the team and wanted to renovate Yankee Stadium, he was clearing a lot of stuff out and just saying, well, we don't need all of these old papers. And I think it was one of our panelists who said, his wife said, these are old papers, let's throw them out. She probably was taking after George Steinbrenner. He said, these are old papers, let's throw them out. Well, he happened to be talking to somebody who had a friend who ran the research library at the Hall of Fame, and he called him up and said, we're going to get rid of a lot of stuff, you might want it. So fortunately, Cliff Cakeline went up to New York and he grabbed, you know, 40-some box or books of the Yankees account ledgers from the 1914 to 1942. So that provided me a career's worth of stuff. And This on the right is actually a page from one of that. The one on the left is a page from a different book. These crop up in various places, but they're very rare. So it's not often that you get to see the team side of what's going on. So let's just quickly look here. The White Sox were not a poorly paid team. So that's one of the myths, you know, that we often hear is the White Sox were very poorly paid. To put this in perspective, in this time period, a team would generally allocate about a third, roughly a third of its total revenues to salary. Today, it's about twice that much. So relative to today, yeah, the teams were very cheap. They kept a lot more of the revenue than the players get today. But as you can see here, these are payroll figures that were not the opening day payrolls that you see published other places. These have been adjusted for the comings and goings of players throughout the year. For example, the Philadelphia A's that year, I think, had 58 players on their team at one time or another. So it's a massive headache to try and figure out how much they actually paid these guys, because they would pay them when they came up, and they would stop paying them when they sold them back to the minor leagues. And so you might have somebody who actually earned $42 for the 2 days he was up. But this is 1919, yeah. So these are the 1919 payrolls right here, and those are the average salaries for those players. And again, on some of these teams, I don't have all of the players. There are a couple of players who are what I would call significant contributors to the team who aren't on there. You know, might have batted 190 times or pitched 90 innings. But for the most part, the players that I'm missing here are guys who played one or two games, had an at-bat or played one inning or never played, but they were on the roster and they were on the payroll. Those are most of the guys I'm missing, which is why I say that I'm 95% sure that these numbers aren't going to change much, and the relative order probably isn't going to change at all. But as you can see, the Chicago White Sox were actually the highest paid team in the American League based on total payroll, and this accounts for players that were bought and sold and traded during the year. So that clearly is not true. But if you're a fan of this, you already knew that. If you've looked at any of the Sabre stuff, you already know that. These panelists up here, Jacob, they've done a lot of research, and they've already exposed all of this. This is not new. The bonus payment is another one. The most famous myth here is that the reason that Eddie Seacott threw the game is because he was really mad because he was screwed out of a bonus. Actually, Eddie Seacott was not denied a bonus because he was never offered a bonus in 1919. The genesis of this probably comes from the fact that he did have a verbal agreement, apparently, with Charlie Comiskey about a bonus that wasn't paid after the 1918 season, which he did receive in the 1919 season. That is not, of course, in a contract if it was a verbal agreement and it wasn't there. Now, Comiskey did give some bonuses on occasion. In fact, the first thing to say is that bonuses were not common at all during this time period. If we just look at 1919, I've looked at 224 player contracts for 1919. 18 of them contained some kind of a bonus clause. Most of those were of the following sort. If you are a good ball player and you behave, we'll give you a $100 bonus at the end of the year. Okay? So, A, there's no way without having the team's books knowing whether they did that. And, of course, who determines whether you were a good ball player, you followed the rules, etc. Okay? Another common bonus was tied to attendance. And, in fact, that's what Charlie Comiskey usually gave in later years, was bonus clauses tied to attendance. If we hit this much attendance, you're going to get this many dollars. Okay? That's easily verifiable whether they hit it or not. But that's the most common kind of bonus. So the only White Sox player who had a bonus in 1919 was Lefty Williams, and he actually had two different bonuses. And these were fairly common bonuses as well. They're what I call performance bonuses, and performance bonuses often looked like this. They said, if you win X number of games, we'll give you, in this case it was $375 if Lefty Williams won 15 games. And if he won 20 games, he was going to get another $500. That was not at all uncommon. Now, those are illegal today. The players union agreed with in the standard contract many, many years ago, probably 50 years ago, that performance clauses would no longer be inserted into contracts. You can't do that. You can have things in there based on playing, you know, how many games or something like that, but you can't have any performance because they didn't want to create any situations where, you know, a manager tells a player to bunt and the player knows, I just need one more hit and I get my bonus. So anyway, bonuses were rare. They weren't given very often, and Eddie Seacott did not have one, although it is possible that there had been some kind of verbal agreement. So again, I'm going to lean only on what evidence I have. There is nothing in a contract that said Eddie Seacott was going to get any kind of bonus for doing anything. So how much were the White Sox paid? Well, here are the salaries that the White Sox got. Grover Loudermilk, they picked up in a trade during the season. They took his contract from the St. Louis Browns, which called for him to earn $3,300. The Sox actually paid $2,640 of that. So that's what would be reflected in their team payroll for that year. But, you know, these guys make about what, Yu Darvish made for each win this year. No, Yu Darvish made for each walk in the first inning this year. All right. So clearly these salaries look really, really low, right? And so in a minute, I'm gonna put them into some perspective. But these salaries are pretty good for players, for ball players at this period of time, all right? So, you know, we look down the row and we see, wow, you know, $2,400 for Dickey Kerr and $3,500 for Chick Gandolfi. They don't look very big, but let's put those into perspective here in a minute. So first of all, let's take a look at the highest paid players of the era. So in 1919, Ty Cobb was the highest paid player, and he made $20,000, which was, unlike a quote that we heard earlier, he maybe didn't have as good a year as the president because he made less than a third of what the president made that year. In fact, it turns out the president made the same in 1919 as he did in 1930 when Babe Ruth was paid $80,000 and made his famous statement that, well, I had a better year than the president did, which is why I made more than he did. The second highest paid player in Major League Baseball was one of the White Sox, okay, Eddie Collins. Again, not anything new. You find this if you read, you know, any of the stuff that Sabre has published on the White Sox. Tris Speaker was also a very highly paid player. Home Run Baker, Babe Ruth, you know, was making $10,000. He would double that, you know, a year later. And then we have a couple of National League players on there. So you see these players, you know, again, $20,000. $20,000, you know, the minimum salary today is closer to $600,000. So $20,000 is about 1/30th of the minimum salary today. But $20,000 went further in 1919 than it does today. So if we take a look at the position players, the White Sox look even a little better when we look at the highest paid player by position here. So if we take a look here, these are the highest paid players in baseball by position. Harry Hooper is the highest paid right fielder, Ty Cobb in center. Babe Ruth in left, he'd be the highest paid pitcher if you wanted to move him over to pitcher because he did pitch about 15 games that year, I think. Home Run Baker was the highest paid third baseman, and Roger Peckinpah was actually the highest paid shortstop that year, just edging out Ben Chapman. So Walter Johnson, and then two White Sox that we have right here, okay, Ray Schalk and Eddie Collins were the highest paid players by their position. And then first baseman is George Sisler, were the highest paid players, and you see their salaries there for 1919. Some of these salaries are a little odd, like, you know, Tris Speaker, earlier I showed, or Home Run Baker making $11,583. That's partly because in 1918 and 1919, Major League owners did something a little different, and they converted almost all players' salaries from annual salaries to monthly salaries because the season was shortened and they could save some money that way. So instead of getting roughly a six-month paycheck, they were only getting 5 1/4 months paychecks, and they adjusted most of those. Now, there's also another common error when looking at these cards is the salaries are listed in two parts, and the second part is listed as a bonus payment for the right for the team to reserve the player's contract for the next year. And that was a legal maneuver that the team started doing in 1915 when the legal front was looking kind of scary for them with the Federal League and the fallout from that. It looked like they might actually lose the right to keep that reserve clause. So in order to try and protect themselves to show that this was actually something that the players were agreeing to allowing the owners to overturn that, you know, turn that contract over one more time, is they built it into the contract. And they said, well, you know, last year we paid you $5,000. This year we're going to pay you $4,500, and we're going to give you a $500 bonus because you're agreeing to let us reserve the contract and renew it at our rate for next year. It turned out that a couple of years later in the very famous Supreme Court decision, they would no longer need that, and indeed, poof, it disappears from contracts very quickly. So how does the Sox salaries, you know, we've been talking about this. I said I wanted to put them into perspective here. Let's take a look at how that stacks up to, you know, the butcher, the baker, and the black baseball player, okay? So if we take a look, the average major league salary in 1919 was $3,781. And as we just saw, Ty Cobb was the highest paid player. He made $20,000. And I referenced, you know, Calvin Coolidge made $75,000 that year. The average U.S. manufacturing worker took home $860 that year. So when we put that into perspective, it would be hard to argue that the players are underpaid, since they were making four times as much as the average worker. In fact, even the lowest paid players were making about $1,200 for a full season, which is a good 50% more than what they would have likely been able to do, because at this time, Eddie Collins was one of the few players with a college degree. Most of these players were going to be working blue-collar jobs, like in the manufacturing industry. So most of them were paid considerably more than they would have been able to earn in any other job. And they were only working 6 months a year. So a lot of them actually did go out and do these jobs during the other 6 months. So they were making considerably more than what the average American was making, because they could go and get a job that would pay them, you know, $400 or $500 during the off-season, and then they'd come back and make $12,000 to $20,000 in the major leagues. So they were making good money compared to the average American. Now, the difference is the average American might get a job with an automobile industry in 1919, and you could count on keeping that job for as long as you wanted. That's not the way the labor market works today. But baseball certainly was more like what the labor market is today. You're more likely to change jobs a few times today, and you were more likely to change jobs back then because the average major league career wasn't that long. And unlike today, there was no pension and there was no medical insurance either. So even though they weren't making a lot of money, they also knew they were going to have another career eventually because they couldn't continue in this one. And it certainly wasn't going to be as lucrative. So there is that to be said about, you know, they're very well paid relative to the average American, but their job isn't going to last as long. So they're going to have to prepare for something else. Not all ball players were as lucky, though. The average black ball player made $304.50. Now, this is not 1919, this is 1918. And I'll tell you right off right now, it's only based on one team because these are the only records we have. But the Hilldale team was a very successful baseball team in black leagues. And their highest paid player, Louis Santop, made $730. Now, he didn't make as much as the average American, but if you pull out what the average black American was making during this time, it was far less. So he was actually making a lot more than he was probably going to make. So baseball was still a good choice for him. So that kind of puts things into perspective in that direction. But let's talk about entertainers, because that's what baseball players are. They're actually entertainers. And if we look at the highest paid entertainers of the day, they weren't vaudevillians. Hollywood was already taking over here. The highest paid entertainer was a woman named Mary Pickford, and she made $10,000 per week in 1919. Now, it helped that she also owned United Artists Studio. She was one of the founders, and that boosted her income. But she was the highest paid woman in America for a long, long time. Did a fairly good job there. So, to conclude here, white ball players were very well paid. Now, this is always an interesting question. I heard the topic come up. How do you know if somebody is underpaid? Well, in economics, we can do it really easily. We can define it very easily. It's not as easy to measure. It's called your marginal revenue. If you earn the additional amount of money you provide for your firm, then you're paid exactly the way you should be. Okay? If you think you're underpaid, it means that you're looking at somebody else and saying, why are they making more than I am? So if we're going to argue that baseball players were underpaid today or then, but not today, there are a lot of professional athletes today who believe that they're underpaid. And it's hard for the average guy to say, how could you be underpaid? Your starting salary was $550,000 and you hit $220,000, okay? But if the guy next to me is making $1.5 million and I'm making $500,000 and he's hitting $221,000, I'm underpaid. Or is he overpaid, okay? So the White Sox were the best paid of those players at the time. Hollywood, however, was way more generous. So were they underpaid as entertainers? Well, they were paid a lot less than the top Hollywood actors were, but they were paid a lot more than the guys with a different skin color who were doing pretty much exactly the same thing. So it was pretty good work if you could get it. Thank you very much.
We were just wondering, what does the average baseball player's salary then, what's the equivalent now? What is that $3,700 equal to now in purchasing power?
That would be close to maybe the minimum salary now, if you adjusted it for inflation. There are a number of ways you can adjust for inflation, but it would still be far less than what they're making today. And the reason for that is because today there's no reserve clause, which is a huge difference, and today there's TV money, which is a bigger difference.
The average salary, $3,700 today would be the average?
Yeah, it'd be roughly $600,000, depending on how you know exactly which you measure you use for adjusting for inflation.
And how about the team for $111,000? What would that translate today?
A couple million dollars.
Okay.
So what a low-paid player is making today is what the whole team was making back then.
You used average salary. Would median salary, to give you a better idea of the number above and below, give you any different numbers?
Yeah, the median salary is very close to this because there weren't a whole lot of players up at the top. Most of the players were in the 5,000, you know. In 1919, for example, if you took the modal salary, for example, it'd be about $2,500. That's right around what most players were making, about $400 a month. And then, you know, like you saw, $20,000 was the top salary, and then the second highest salary was $15,000. The third highest salary was only $10,000. So there aren't many people up there. You had to really be a superstar, and the reason you were able to get that much money is because you could threaten to hold out, and the team needed you not as badly as you needed the team, but badly enough that they would cave into some of your demands.
I got the mic, so I guess it means I'm supposed to talk. He just sort of got my question about median salary, but on a monthly basis, since that's how these people were actually being paid, was per month, which allows you to do people with minimum time with the team. What was the average, and if you know it too, the median monthly salary?
Well, if you divide the salaries by six, so the baseball players are paid only during the season, and their salary would usually start in April and go through September, so roughly 6 months. As I said, in 1919, it was a little shorter. Now, this is a bad year to look at for the average monthly pay, and I've actually looked at this before. Players outside of these war years, if you were on a monthly contract, your annual salary was far lower than the average player who was on an annual contract. Monthly contract players tended to be younger players or, you know, more marginal players, and annual contract players tended to be better players. And there was a reason for this, and that was because many players would actually negotiate out the 10-day clause. And the 10-day clause was what allowed the owner to say, I only have to give you 10 days notice, and then I can stop paying you. And so even if you signed a one-year contract, what was in the contract was Clause 7, which was the 10-day clause, which said the owner reserves the right to terminate the contract with 10 days' notice. That was the most frequent thing negotiated out of a contract, and it was almost always with players who were just a little bit more established. And it was an easy thing for the owners to give up because, you know, the owner of the Tigers is not going to cut Ty Cobb in 1920 because he gets mad at him for some reason. So giving him that in a contract negotiation really cost him nothing. But you were never going to see that for a rookie, for example. No, you know, first-timer was going to negotiate that. Well, the monthly contracts didn't even have that. You were paid by the month, and your services were literally day-to-day. So you have a monthly contract, and when I sell you, I'm not paying you anymore. I don't have to give you any notice whatsoever. So that's really, the difference was more of, you know, the more substantial the player, the less likely you were to be on a monthly contract, except during these war years when most players were, you know, reverted to monthly contracts. And part of that was also to get around worrying what was going to happen if this player got drafted. Do I have any kind of commitment to this player if he's drafted and I've signed him to a one-year contract? If I sign him to a monthly contract, I also eliminate that problem.
You showed Eddie Collins had a salary that was more than twice as much as anybody else in the White Sox. Obviously, this is an elite team full of elite players. So what do we know, if anything, about resentment between the players in terms of kind of the stratification of salary? You know, you got roughly the same job, but if the guy down the line is getting twice as much as you, what does that do to their mindset?
Well, I'm not the expert on this, but I think just the fact that the player's nickname for Eddie Collins was Cocky kind of tells you what they thought of him. So they weren't real pleased. I mean, they thought he was a little elite because he was college educated, and he was making a lot more money. Now, he's also a really, really good player, right? I mean, he was a Hall of Famer. So it's not like he wasn't worth it, but that kind of thing could breed resentment. How do you know you're underpaid when the guy next to you is making more than you are? We're all playing baseball. You're a better hitter than I am, but you're making more money than me. So
that could very well lead to some of the kind of resentment and, you know, some of the reasons that, you know, you say, maybe I will take this money. Comiskey's not going to give it to me. He gives it to other people instead. So,
you were talking about entertainers' salaries, and the comparison would be, I guess, to live audiences, not to screen audiences. Vaudeville is the big entertainment factor then. And for the top tiers of vaudeville, do you have any comparisons for that?
Off the top of my head, I do not. I have done some research on that, but I couldn't tell you what the top vaudeville players were making at the time. The best ones were making a lot. And like ball players, they were on the road a lot, too. So your other point to Hollywood, it wasn't as grueling a lifestyle necessarily because you didn't have to do as much traveling. But I really don't know. They weren't making $10,000 a week. I can guarantee you that much. But they were, the best of them were pretty well paid. So Al Jolson made a lot of money on vaudeville, for example. He was very well paid.
I have a question about the individual player salaries. What was your source material strictly those players' cards in that are on file that you showed?
For this particular talk?
For the White Sox.
Yeah, for this particular talk it was. I've also gotten salary information from team documents, too. Okay.
Did those numbers include World Series bonus?
Those numbers up there were strictly salaries. They'd included no World Series shares. They did not include, like the Lefty Williams salary that I put there, did not include the bonus that he got paid. So I was just showing you the contracted salary that the player was promised to earn no matter what.
Okay.
So, in fact, that was often, the Yankees used that argument all the time with their players. They would say, hey, you're going to be playing in the World Series. We're always in the World Series, and you're going to get a cut of that check, so you don't need this big raise. So you're playing for the Yankees, and we pretty much can guarantee you a share of the World Series.
Did you research, because I know at the time of the trial, the New York Herald published all eight players' salaries and bonuses and World Series bonuses, and it shows that Seacott had a $3,000 bonus for 1919. That was the carryover.
That was the one I mentioned before.
Yeah,
that
the
was,
carryover from 18. It says Happy Felsch had a $3,000 bonus, and it had Lefty Williams. Is there more research to be done to try to? Is it possible that there's more numbers out there that could change?
Well, you could check the White Sox ledgers would be one way. But what's more likely, and this is what I've found in my research, is you're getting bad information from other places. So you've got the contract cards, for example, and when I use those contract cards and I go back and I check salary references that I see, and I've got about 1,000 citations that I've pulled from books and newspapers of, you know, here's how much so-and-so is making. On about 70% of those, it's not the same salary that was recorded as being paid on the contract, which makes sense because a newspaper, for example, is telling a story. It's not doing a scholarly dissertation. So if I wanted to know how much you were making, I'd ask you, right? And you'd tell me. And unless I'm doing investigative reporting, I'm not going to doubt your word. I'm just going to report, hey, this is what Joe said he was making. Well, Joe may have an agenda. He may want to overestimate or underestimate his salary. I mean, teams and players did this all the time to try to make a point when they were talking to the press. A team would say, we offered this guy a huge raise. And, you know, the player would say, I'm really underpaid. And, well, they obviously agreed on a salary, but they both say a different number. Well, there's no way to check on that. Well, now there is a way to check on that. And what we find is that most of the time when salaries are reported, they aren't accurate because the person who was giving them the salary had a particular reason for telling them that the salary, what they told them. Or, in another case, is I'm trying to remember 20 years ago what I made. I couldn't tell you what I made 20 years ago. I could tell you about what I made. I could tell you what I wish I made. Or I can tell you what I made that my employer shouldn't have paid me. But I don't know what I made. So I think I'm out of time, so thank you very much.